Welcome to the third episode of the Research Liaison Team Open Knowledge Podcast. My name is Holly Limbert and I'm the Repository and Open Access Librarian at the University of Derby. I'm based in the library and I manage the university's research repository, Eudora, and provide advice and guidance on the open research landscape with a particular focus on open access. The release of this podcast is in celebration of Open Access Week and I will be joined by some expert guest speakers to discuss their roles and passions, equity and open knowledge, and the future of scholarly communications. This episode will focus on open access funder mandates. I'm pleased to welcome Julie Baldwin, who is a research librarian at the University of Nottingham, and in her current role, she primarily supports researchers in their open access publishing endeavours, but has a strong interest in championing innovation and advocacy, and is also interested heavily in copyright. Julie has published an article examining the early stages of the UK Scholarly Communications Licence Initiative. The UK Scholarly Communication Licence, attempting to cut through the Gordian knot of the complexities of funder mandates, publisher embargoes, and researcher caution in achieving open access, co-authored with Professor Stephen Pinfield at the University of Sheffield. Welcome, Julie, and thank you for joining me today. To begin, could you please tell us a little about yourself, your background, and your professional interests?
I'm a research librarian with University of Nottingham Library's research support team. So we support our researchers at the university with kind of advice and guidance and support around kind of scholarly communications and publishing. I do a lot of work around supporting researchers on open access and helping them navigate various funder policies and their obligations. I also do some work around research data management and also copyright, and I'm also interested in other forms of kind of widening open access, so like open access monographs, I think. I'm relatively new to my professional career. Before working at Nottingham, I worked in customer services roles for about 5 years, then qualified with my MA in librarianship in 2017, then spent the last 4 years working at Nottingham in open access. So it's really all I've known, open access and libraries. So very happy to be talking to you today.
Thank you. And obviously open access and kind of the scholarly comms landscape is kind of ever evolving, ever shifting, probably more than ever at the minute. And one of the interesting things that you mentioned there was kind of, you know, the funder policies. And I suppose what we're seeing now is more or less an alignment between some of the large external funding organisations and their open access policies. So I'm thinking about, you know, UK Research and Innovation, Coalition S, Wellcome Trust, etc. Why do you think this is? Do you think this will extend also to the next policy for RES, the next open access policy for RES?
I think we're kind of moving now into a new stage of open access. So you kind of started out kind of with open access in around the 2000s. That was kind of an opportunity born of the internet and quite a grassroots type movement, kind of important scholarly movement, but it didn't really kind of reach critical mass until we've had the policies that we've kind of still got or have just recently had in place in the UK. So, you know, the Wellcome Trust policy, UK Research Council, then there was REF. So obviously all of these are starting to make the open access movement kind of gained speed and had, you know, more weight and bigger impact. But it did mean with the funders coming on board that then there was a very fine balance between the different people involved in these policies. So you've got the funder, you've got the institution, the publisher and the researcher, which has caused some issues and it caused some kind of ingrained issues from the policies that were in place, which there was a large kind of reliance of hybrid open access, which, you know, kind of has become quite an unsustainable model for open access.
Yeah.
A lot of funders kind of piling all the money into publishers' pockets via this model. And that, again, that's kind of that balance. The publishers seem to kind of be tipping in the weight of the publishers, that balance. They were able to quickly kind of maneuver their own publishing models to suit this new funding stream from funders. And, you know, there's also this issue around copyright, with researchers wanting to publish basically where they want, which is fair enough. But with these funder mandates, obviously, an effort that they have to kind of with, but at the same time, the funders don't want to be super prescriptive, so then you've got things like embargoes coming into play where publishers are asking researchers to embargo their work, which to a point complied with funder mandates, and to a point allowed researchers to publish where they want, because researchers up to now are still signing over their copyright
to
publishers. And again, that's kind of an ingrained issue, which kind of comes all comes back to what they see as impact, and the kind of kudos that they would get from publishing in various venues. So they've given their copyright freely away to these journals, because in return they will get the kudos of publishing with that particular journal. So again, it basically becomes this big knot. It's a big knot of ingrained practices which basically haven't amounted to immediate open access.
Right.
I think we're now at a stage where the funders have got to a point where they realise that these policies aren't fit for purpose anymore, or haven't been fit for purpose, and it's not achieving really what they want. The cult has happened. I don't think you could deny that. I think now it's more or less accepted that open access is a good thing. It's something that people should be doing, but the mechanisms that have been in place for the certainly the last couple of years don't really seem that sustainable. And of course, there was a point when different funders were saying different things. You had F, who wanted green open access. You had UKRI or the research councils who wanted gold open access. So again, it's been very complicated. It's been a very complicated landscape. So I think there's kind of two reasons, basically, all of that kind of summing up to two reasons why I think we're now seeing this kind of alignment. One is the funders wanting to achieve immediate open access, and now maybe at a stage where they feel like that cultural shift has happened enough to move the conversation on, and that kind of wanting the policies to be aligned with each other. So, like you said, there is more or less an alignment between what UKRI want, what Coalition S want, what Working Trust want. So I think those really are the kind of main reasons why I think this is happening. You know, it did kind of converge with the Plan S movement, which was what, 2018 now, I think.
Yeah.
So I think they've now got that kind of overarching set of principles, that manifesto that people are now using in their own local OA policies, with the most recent being the UKRI policy. The REF aspect is interesting. I think it's 100% going to be impacting a lot more researchers, so that will definitely be something that I think funders are gonna and Research England are gonna bear in mind. I mean, the UKRI, I think UKRI are putting in more or less double the amount of funding to fund their new policy. So, right. And that's just the UKRI funded authors.
Yeah.
So if you know, if that was to extend to everyone who's covered by REF as well, you know,
yeah,
that's talking a lot more money or some other element of, you know, or something, if they were trying to go down more focusing on the green route, that's a lot more effort and pressure that they've got to work with publishers. So I think this UKRI policy is probably the direction of travel, but I can't see it personally being practical for them to have the exact same policy as the UKRI.
Yeah.
Policy. I think in the policy it will say that if you are compliant with the UKRI policy, you will also be compliant with the REF policy.
It does. You're right. It does.
But that's not the other way around, is
no.
it? So I think it's kind of a flavour of the intention of what they want from REF. But I don't personally see it being something that will be convinced. There'll be a lot of forceful kind of lobbying and people wanting to kind of, you know, put in their own viewpoints on this. I think that there's going to be quite a robust consultation.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think,
yeah,
if you think about kind of the way that UKRI and Plan S etc have gone in terms of green and zero embargo etc, I always think, or it makes me wonder about the stuff that people have already published that they want to submit for the next REF.
Yeah.
You know, what's going to happen with that in terms of kind of compliance, which is a bit of a worry. But yeah, I mean, and you've already touched on this quite a lot in your previous response, but I suppose one of the biggest challenges for researchers when ensuring compliance with these open access policies, particularly with the Plan S, you know, and UKRI and Wellcome, is rights retention, you know, and zero embargo requirements. I suppose one of the things I'm most interested in is, what's the greatest challenge, you think, for researchers relating to these requirements in particular? How do you think the research, like researchers, what do you think their kind of response is? I mean, you've probably had many responses to this already in your day-to-day work, but just interested to know,
yeah,
what the greatest challenges are that you think.
It's a difficult area to speak about because it's so... It's such new territory. It's quite a. I think ultimately the biggest challenge at the moment is that it's a completely unproven area. It's not. This retaining isn't a practice that goes on currently at a one scale. You know, as I've mentioned, a lot of academics, in order to publish with the publishers they want to. And I think even though there are a lot of reasons to retain rights, up until now there hasn't really been the kind of... It's not as important to researchers, I don't think. It hasn't been. I think they are very happy that they can publish in the venues that they want to. That is the price they are willing to pay for it. But of course, we know, and funders know, that this then puts everyone in a bit of a pickle in terms of complying with these mandates. I think one of the issues we are going to see now, they can say exactly how people can use the work, and they're getting the economic benefits from it. But we're now starting to see some publishers kind of outrightly saying, you know, we don't agree with rights retention, where these policies are starting to protection mechanism within their policies, which mostly relies on researchers, including like a little bit of text in their policy, yeah. in their submission for publication, where they kind of say that they will retain copyright in the author's accepted manuscript that is created upon acceptance into that journal and will be licensed under a Creative Commons license or CC BY license. So it's this kind of prior notification that funders are asking researchers to put into their work. The issue being that this seems, as far as we can tell, this seems to be something which is relatively legally sound in terms of copyright law. Because first owner of copyright are allowed to do this, and they are giving this prior notification to the publisher to say that this is what they intend to do. The issue is that publishers are going to be coming back at them under contract law. So, you know, if they then stick a publishing contract under a researcher's nose that does say, you know, I will abide by these embargo lengths and this type of thing, and the researcher signs it, then puts in something into a repository with zero embargo, publishers could then argue that they've broken their contract. You know, it goes back to this kind of contract law versus copyright law type of thing. And basically, it's unproven. No one really wants to take that first step of being the institution that goes against this, against the publisher. So until that happens, we don't know, we don't really know who's in the right, because in UK law, it's kind of based on, you know, case law, so we need that kind of first precedent to suggest what, you know, what which of these is going to be the one that comes out on top. So I think for libraries, universities, and I mean, at the ultimately, funders and publishers are putting researchers in the middle, and it's, you know, they're between a bit of a rock and a hard place. We're also that same place. We're trying to advise on this. I think it's very hard for anyone to kind of, as a librarian in any institution, to kind of say exactly, this is definitely the case, because we just don't know. So it's a case of trying to highlight to researchers what the situation is, I guess. But it's hard enough for, I mean, I'm someone who knows, I'd like to think of myself as someone well-versed in copyright, as someone, as a researcher, you know, who's, this is such a fringe thing of what they're doing every day. It's such a hard thing to get your head around, and it's so complicated. But I think one of the biggest challenges is really, how can researchers be able to make informed decisions on this? Because the only person who can really make that decision, whether they want to be potentially in breach of their contract or do they want to be in breach of their funder agreements, you know, we can't make that decision for them. We don't want to, most librarians aren't in a situation where they're able to advise on this with great expertise, and, you know, even at the end of the day, expertise isn't the same as being a qualified lawyer.
Absolutely.
So we're in a difficult position, the researcher is in a difficult position, and the funders and the publishers are just both going to be relying on their interpretation of the law. Yeah, until something kind of gives, I'm not sure how this is going to be resolved. But having said all of that, if we can get authors retaining rights, that is going to be a amazing thing. And if there can be a way forward through this, authors will have so much more control over their own work. And I think we are, especially as all these policies are becoming more and more geared towards immediate open access.
Yeah.
Authors having the control over their own work, it can only help this. They can then comply with these policies, and obviously the whole reason that we're all doing this is because we all believe open access is a good thing.
Yeah.
So the more opportunity people have to make work open access, the better, I suppose. So yeah, I suppose I just wanted to kind of add that in, so it's not just all doom and gloom. I think it's a great thing if it can be achieved.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, I suppose sometimes I think of it like, you know, with rights retention, like the concept of open access, you know, way back. It's kind of like the rights retention strategy, or just rights retention in general. It's like, what will it be in, like, you know, I don't know, 10 years time? Maybe we'll be a similar kind of movement with what open access was 20 years ago. I think we've got quite a long way to go before it becomes kind of like general practice. And like you say, we need that first example, don't we, of where, you know, someone challenged a publisher or but I think that's really interesting what you were saying about, you know, librarians and information professionals kind of being the middleman between the funder mandates and the researchers, and kind of trying to communicate these really complex policies. And this has kind of come up quite a few times in different conversations that I've had with people, but do you think that funders should do more to support this kind of, you know, to support librarians and information professionals and the communication to research communities? Do you think they could do more?
To help library and information professionals?
Yeah, and to help kind of like get the message out there more, because I feel like we kind of just get landed with these policies, and then it's kind of like, right, well, there's the policy, now communicate it.
Yeah I think that's exactly right. I think there's often a bit of a mismatch between, well, I think there's a mismatch between three people involved. I think the people who write the policies are, I'm presuming, very unlikely to be the people implementing the policies.
Right.
And the people implementing the policies, i.e. librarians and information professionals, are trying to convey these messages to researchers on the ground who have to abide by them, but who, again, aren't versed in them in the way that we are either. So there's kind of a complete mismatch between all three, and I think, I guess, so it kind of flows down from the top, from the funders through us to the researchers. So I think, again, kind of being in that middle position, the thing we really need is clear, consistent messaging. The funders saying one thing, we interpret it in a specific way, and then the researchers have to interpret what we say in a specific way.
Yeah.
So I think clarity and consistency is really important, and I think that's been really, again, talking about earlier about different policies sometimes saying different things.
Yeah.
It's so easy to get confused. It's so easy to have one thing saying one thing and one thing saying another, and again, it's that weighing up of, oh, what do I do? You know, do I be compliant with REF, or do I be compliant with my funder? Is there going to be a difference? If I publish in this publication, will it be okay for one thing but not for another funder? So it's that kind of, hopefully the movement towards aligning policy should kind of help from that point of view. But I think maybe they've already started that step to help in that way. I think the alignment of policies is one way of getting kind of good, clear and consistent messaging. The other thing is, if you ever sit in a room or on a Zoom call or something with a bunch of librarians looking at a policy, I'm sure, you know, there's going to be an issue of kind of coverage, you know, because a funder will probably think, work on a policy for ages and ages, they think, oh, we've covered every single thing. You know, this really covers all the bases, and then you get in a room, or, you know, you pore over it with a couple of librarians, and then, you know, 2 minutes later, they've got 101 new questions or new scenarios that haven't been thought of in the guidance and the policy. So something I'm aware of in the new UKRI policy is there's no mention of the journal checker tool, the tool that Planet One Trust has kind of championed. And then it's a case of, well, what does that mean? You know, it's that interpretation again. Does that mean that they aren't saying that it's something that we should be using? Are they saying, is it just something they haven't thought of? You know, it's that kind of double guessing or second guessing what funders are thinking. The main issue, especially with the current policies, is coming in a bit of some like dribs and drabs. We've got the main policy, we have the guidance, but there's lots of different pieces of guidance around and funding and all the things that we don't have yet. So trying to plan for communication stuff when you've got big gaps in knowledge is quite hard. So kind of a clear roadmap, but also a quick one, because I think there's some guidance we're still not going to be getting until like December, which, you know, given the policy starts in April, if there's some part of it that you either need to get out to your entire research community or it needs to go through some sort of university committee to be able to put in the mechanism for the policy, I think, so I think clear, consistent messaging from funders, also a clear contact point for when we do come up with these extra scenarios that haven't been thought up, someone you can go to and actually get a good response from. And then if things can't all be launched at once, having kind of a really clear guidance exactly when the next piece of guidance is coming out.
So it could be said that the funder mandates have been designed to positively disrupt the academic publishing industry. However, it's no secret that this has remained remarkably resilient. Do you think that the funders are doing enough to put pressure on an industry that is still very much dominated by the big publishers and big players like Elsevier, Taylor & Francis, etc.? And I suppose one way in which they're doing this is via the introduction of these read and publish agreements or the transitional agreements. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think they are doing enough?
So most of these policies are now not supporting the hybrid open access model, or rather, I suppose when I say support, I mean funding. So technically you could still comply by publishing in a hybrid model journal, but UKRI or Wellcome Trust wouldn't fund it. What they are willing to fund are, like you said, these transformative agreements. So, yeah, I guess that is the funders kind of putting their money where their mouth is in terms of they are willing to support this type of model. And that in itself is putting the pressure on the publishers to come up with these models and to come up with financially sustainable transformative agreements. We know with, like I said, with some of the bigger players, the negotiations for these types of agreements can go on for a very long time and, you know, very tactical and we're trying to get the most value for money that we can. Publishers are also similarly trying to get the most money out of us that they can. So, yeah, the funders supporting transformative agreements is it is a useful way of, again, I guess it's the whole point, it's transformative, it's transitional. Yeah. It's trying to move away from one model and trying to actively disrupt the publishing models that we have now and moving it to, I mean, ultimately, I guess, a pay to publish model as the way that people access content. We've got to hope that these transitional agreements aren't going to become just the new big deal. Right. You know, it's not a case of just packaging up, read and publish together forevermore. These are supposed to be transitional. They're supposed to be moving towards media open access for everything. If everything's immediately open access, why would you have a subscription cost? You wouldn't.
No.
So I think it's interesting to see that there's a time limit that the funders are willing to fund these types of models. I think it's 2024, end of 2024.
Yeah.
That to me signals that again they're seeing it as a kind of a stepping stone to something else towards full open access for all journal content, which seems kind of ambitious when you say it like that. But the University of California, I think I'm right in saying the University of California negotiations, which is obviously very high profile Elsevier negotiations, which took years and years and years. I'm pretty sure that the deal they eventually struck, the detail of the deal was that it was 100% published cost, 0% read cost.
Wow.
So I think they were already kind of switching to what they wanted to see, the kind of long-term plan to be. So, but again, it's going to come down to these publishers are able to maneuver much quicker than we are, much quicker than funders are. They have probably people on this type of thing as their entire job, you know. How can we react to this? How can we get ahead of these policies? What kind of things can we do to put ourselves in the best position, which we as librarians and institutions do not have. So I think we're always going to be slightly on the back foot in that sense, but it is a positive step that funders are putting their foot down around hybrid open access. They're the ones who have been funding this model for such a long time. So the fact that they've recognised that this isn't sustainable is a good thing. I think the other kind of element to these funder mandates is sanctions.
Yeah.
I think, you know, most policies, there's an element of carrot and stick. And I think in years gone by, we've been missing a bit of that stick. I think I was talking to someone once and they said, you know, a policy without sanctions, basically a policy with no teeth.
Mm-hmm.
But we know with things like the REF, the financial incentive to comply with the various policies of the REF has meant such a much wider institutional focus on if there's not something like that, which is likely to be, because obviously the rest portion of that QR funding, which isn't really something that's translatable to kind of these, you know, individual grant funded type projects, but sanctions at some level, either to the institutional, the fund, or to the individual, would be one way to put more pressure on everyone. And I'm not saying that that's what I agree with, I'm just saying that's one way of doing it. But it is going to be putting everyone in a... It again goes back to that kind of being in between a rock and a hard place. But the leverage that a funder has is that they can sanction. So they're the ones with the money, and they're the ones who can decide who gets it, who doesn't get it.
we just go back to this, what we were talking about, just about transformative agreements and things, and obviously, you know, the funders are trying to transition to 100% open access, but then potentially this could mean instead of paying for, you know, subscription access, it's all paying for publishing, which kind of just takes knowledge commodification from one area to another, really. What are your thoughts on Diamond Open Access being a viable option for authors to ensure compliance with funder mandates? And just in general, really, I think, you know, Diamond potentially has a sustainable future over kind of gold. So maybe that could be a way for authors to ensure compliance whilst, you know, not having to pay a fee.
Yeah, I think whether it's more sustainable than gold, I don't know. But so with Diamond Open Access being kind of free to read and free to publish, it is a really interesting model. I think my understanding is most of the funding, you know, the kind of funding model for this, whilst it varies, is usually kind of either it gets subsidised by other journals in a kind of a portfolio of journals, some which would charge, or they're run by learned societies or institutions who kind of, they're the ones who kind of take on the cost. So, I mean, my experience is, and kind of my understanding is, they might not always be the biggest publishers, they might not have access to the best systems or software or technical infrastructure, they might be run by volunteers, they might be quite small journals. So I think for this reason, there is need for support for them to kind of have a diverse array of options, you know, for people to publishing. And I think none of these things I've just mentioned makes them any less respectable or reputable. Yeah, you're right. By them being free to publish in and likely to be offering a compliant option, they are certainly one way that researchers can publish whilst being compliant with funder. And it kind of, like, it kind of takes out a possible element, a possible barrier to it by not having to pay to publish with them. I guess, again, on the basis that some of them might be smaller kind of publishing outfits, you always need to make sure that they're complying with all the various elements of these policies, right. You know, because there's now kind of technical, you know, requirements for journals to have and be listed in Director of Open Access Journals and that type of thing. So again, it's weighing up all the different options. Coalition S, I think, have done a report on Diamond Open Access, so it's interesting to kind of bring this up. I think they are trying to do more work on this publishing model and kind of strengthen it as an option to publish in. I think
they have. You're right.
I think it was something like the Diamond OA Journals Report. Yeah. Or something.
There's definitely the option then for it to be something to consider for authors. And also, if you're thinking about potentially, I always think about, you know, some of these funder mandates might be said to favour some of the more research-intensive institutions, where there may be more money to support, you know, the gold route to open access. But for those institutions that are post-92 or, you know, less research intensive, potentially Diamond could be a different option.
It's widening out the publishing options for people, like you say, in different situations, at different stages of their career, at different institutions.
Right.
It kind of goes, it's a lot of what gets talked about in the kind of open monograph spiel, is that what we need is a diverse publishing landscape.
Absolutely.
It's not, you either publish in Elsevier or or you don't publish at all. Mm. You know, there needs to be lots of different options. And yeah, Diamond is definitely an option that, like you say, is something that can be available to everyone and might be more helpful for some people in certain situations, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for listening to this third episode of the Open Knowledge Podcast, and special thanks to Julie for such an insightful discussion around some of the complexities that we're seeing with funder mandates. We'll be back soon with more episodes.